reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Afternoon, we'll call 03-1333-DOLR versus J. Andrew Felley. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Felley is Terry E. Johnson. Mr. Johnson?
May it please the Court, I have the privilege of appearing before you as the attorney for Mr. Felley. My name is Terry Johnson. This appeal is an appeal by Mr. Felley from a recommendation, findings and recommendations by the referee with regard to a multi-count complaint that was filed against him relating to three different clients. Although 11 counts were filed originally, the referee only found that three had been proven. And although I noticed in reviewing our brief and preparing for this that we characterize this as a case in which we are attacking the findings, I think as I thought about it a little bit more, I don't think that's really the case. I think what we are really discussing is the conclusions of law that the referee reached as a result of the findings that were made and attempting to match up the limited factual findings that the referee made with any conceivable finding that could be made as the violation of the rules. I think that's important for two reasons. First of all, that we really, I don't think in this appeal, are really examining the facts in any great detail. The findings are the findings, and I don't think they're subject to serious challenge. And number two, because contrary to what we argued in our brief, the standard of review is considerably different. It is not a clearly erroneous standard as it would be if we were attacking findings of fact, but rather essentially a de novo review, that you are being asked to determine whether the referee's findings as to the law, the conclusions as to the finding on the counts, is consonant with the factual findings that were made.
Counsel, what was the penalty that was sought prior to going before the referee by OLR?
If I recall correctly, it was a one-year suspension based upon the 11 counts.
Thank you.
And the referee concluded that based upon the three counts that had been proven, that a 90-day suspension was the recommended discipline. And I would suggest to you that the only way that that's relevant is that I don't think OLR asks for these penalties loosely. I think they give some thought to them. And the fact that they had asked for a year in the first place, when frankly some what I would characterize as being the more serious counts were on the eight on which they didn't prevail, shed some light on the reasonableness of the 90-day suspension that was recommended. One of one of the principal reasons why we did appeal is because not only of the findings on the counts, but because we think that even if the counts were all sustained, the three that are left, a 90-day suspension is discipline that is altogether too harsh.
So what are the three counts that were left?
The three counts that are left are counts 2, 5, and 9. Count 2 is the only count which relates to substantive representation of clients. The other two, in one form or another, are characterized as non-cooperation counts. Count 2 is a count that is factually admitted in large part. That is, in one of the three factual situations, the Revelinsky divorce, Mr. Felley failed to appear at a December 18, 2000 hearing. And that requires some understanding of the facts, and if you bear with me, I'd like to go through that for just a moment. The principal important fact, perhaps the only important fact in the Revelinsky divorce that bears upon Mr. Felley's conduct is the fact that he was representing a lady who had no interest in being divorced. And it wasn't because of romance or passion. It was because she and her husband, I'm assuming there was romance and passion there once, but they had been living separate from each other and on what one would call a friendship basis for many years. I don't recall how many.
And
five. And she was on good terms with her husband, but they had no relationship of the type we would consider to be a normal marital relationship. The husband filed for divorce because he had just retired or was beginning to retire. Mr. Felley was retained to represent Mrs. Revelinsky. And although he initially took steps to try to have, for example, a temporary support order entered, that was one of the counts that was brought originally, the failure to bring that, as we established at the hearing, there really wasn't any reason to have a temporary support order because these people had already arranged their lives through their 5 years of separation and worked things out and didn't need the intervention of a court to try to get them to go along. What Mr. Felley discovered early on is that the problem in this divorce is that Mrs. Revolinsky had some serious health problems and was in need of primarily medication care, but continuing medical care because of the various medications she was taking, and it was extremely expensive for her. And there simply was no way that Mr. Revolinsky, Mrs. Revolinsky, or the two of them together could afford to either pay for this medication and the associated medical care or the insurance if they had to. However, as long as they were married, Mrs. Revolinsky was eligible for coverage under her husband's group health coverage through his then former employer because he had continuation benefits. And there was no dispute between the husband and wife, at least on this point, that they both agreed they needed to keep this health insurance in effect. And what the record demonstrates is that, refreshingly, I think, for once, not only did the couple involved in the divorce cooperate, but the lawyers who were representing the opposing sides cooperated, and they attempted over time to find a creative way consistent with their desire to become divorced eventually in which they could accommodate this common need of making sure that they could have medical care for Mrs. Revolinsky. What they found out is that there wasn't any way to do it, basically. They went to the court at one point and suggested they could work out an agreement and then just put the divorce on hold until she turned 65, which would have been, I think, 3 or 4 years, if I recall correctly. And she would then become eligible for Medicare, and there wouldn't be any need to be worried about the insurance. And Judge Gooley in Milwaukee said, understandably, I don't let cases sit on the shelf here for 3 or 4 years. You either have to move ahead with this divorce or get it dismissed. And what happened then is the parties then moved toward reaching an agreement that they would then use to form the basis for resolving a second divorce action later. They would reach an agreement, have the first action dismissed, and then intend, that dispute exists in the case, no longer, I think, material because of the findings that the referee made as to whether that agreement might be binding or not, but it at least would be a starting point for a later divorce on issues they never really disagreed on in the first place, who would get the house, who would get the pension, things like that. And what happened is after Mr. Felley understood that that agreement was reached, the matter was on the calendar for a status hearing at which the judge had said, for not the first time, if you aren't here with an agreement, I'm going to dismiss this divorce. Mr. Felley said in his deposition he thought that this agreement might very well be signed and unfiled before the hearing. He didn't go to the hearing. And when the opposing counsel showed up, the record reflects, it's undisputed, opposing counsel told the judge that day on the record that Mr. Felley understands that we have this agreement. He probably thought he didn't need to appear. Now, Judge Gooley wasn't terribly happy with that, and frankly, I'm not at all critical of him for not being terribly happy with that. And Mr. Felley already has said in his testimony that he should have gone. But what he's charged with on that count, so the facts are essentially undisputed, what he's charged with on that count is failing to promptly and diligently represent his client. And we believe the facts indisputably show that the client had no interest in having Mr. Felley there. Whether Mr. Felley appeared or not would only mean either the divorce action would move ahead to another status date or it would be dismissed. And it was in Mrs. Revolinsky's interest, whether she ever really understood it or not, there seems to be some question as to how much of this Mrs. Revolinsky really understood fully or can recapture now. Whether she understood it or not, her best interests were served by having this divorce action terminated, because then the one thing she really needed, her insurance coverage, would be preserved. So that while we don't doubt that Mr. Felley should have been there that day, the rule he cited with violating is not diligently and promptly representing a client. And
Mr. Johnson, did this particular count arise because the client complained to OLR? How did it arise?
The client complained about a variety of matters. This was, if memory serves me, there were 3 or 4 counts, and there were 2 that grew out of the Revolinsky matter that are still before us today. There were at least 2 or 3 others. Mrs. Revolinsky made many allegations that she was not being communicated with properly by Mr. Felley, that she wasn't getting letters. There was a substantial factual issue before the referee as to whether she got letters and lost them or whether she just didn't get the letters. Mr. Felley and his secretary testified. There was testimony about to put it politely, the state of Mrs. Revolinsky's record-keeping and things of that type. And those issues were resolved by the referee by finding that OLR had not demonstrated failure to keep the client apprised, failure to communicate, failure to respond to the phone calls. So what is left is this failure to appear at this hearing and the related count relating to one of the letters, which I'll get to in a moment.
Thank you.
Our position is that if the charge here was that he had showed disrespect for a tribunal or had failed to follow the rules of a tribunal in some respect, there might be some merit to the allegation. but where the allegation is that he was failing to diligently and promptly represent his client, and the hearing was one that we believe the record demonstrates the client literally had no interest in whether Mr. Felley went there or not, his admitted failure not to go doesn't rise to the level of a violation of the disciplinary rules and therefore should not represent a finding of a violation and is irrelevant to the question of discipline.
What about the failure to get the agreement signed?
Well, first of all, the referee found against OLR on those subjects and determined that given Mr. Felley's explanation about what he was trying to do, number one, and Mr. Podell's expert testimony about the difficulties of this, that what he had done was acceptable. One can't force another side to sign an agreement. Mr. Felley's testimony, I think the record supports the idea that there was ample reason to believe at the time the case was dismissed the agreement would be signed. But in all honesty, I don't mean to sound cavalier, but what of it if it wasn't?
Mr. Johnson, if the agreement was signed, what was going to happen at the hearing?
What would have happened at the hearing is if the agreement had been signed, they were going to dismiss the case. The agreement was that they were going to enter into this marital property agreement before dismissing the case. The current divorce would be dismissed either at that hearing or by a stipulation.
So that I understand correctly, whether he was there, whether the agreement was signed or not, the contemplated result at that hearing was that the case would be dismissed either way.
Correct. The only way in which what was contemplated at the time, according to what we believe the evidence shows and the findings the referee made factually, didn't happen is that Mr. Revolinsky didn't sign the agreement.
Had the agreement been signed, though, wouldn't it have been a way of simplifying the divorce when the divorce occurred? This way, without a signed agreement and a dismissal, she hired new lawyers and they had to start that process again.
Yes, what was sought to be achieved is, at least in the moral, mental sense, if we agree on these things, those issues are off the table. If we start to squabble later, we won't go back. Mr. Podell offered the opinion, Mr. Felley offered the opinion, that he felt that agreement would have been binding and effective in the later divorce. There is a legal issue there that I think there is some doubt about as to whether the dismissal and when they signed it would have caused a problem. But it was, at worst, half a loaf is better than none, and that was the best they could do under the circumstances. What happened, unfortunately, factually, is that shortly thereafter, the employer went bankrupt, and the health insurance was lost, all of which would have happened whether the divorce was pending or not. So all of this planning and so on ended up not working out as well as it had hoped to be worked out because other events overtook the couple. Eventually, Mr. Revolinsky then filed another divorce action, and he proceeded with the divorce. It was always Mr. Revolinsky, who was the petitioner, who was seeking the divorce, not Mrs. Revolinsky. She was simply responding to it, and I think the record demonstrates largely simply saying, we aren't living together as husband and wife anyway. If you want a divorce, as long as I can continue to live as I have been, the whole situation has really very little, for most of us, surprisingly little impact on her.
Well, let's talk about 5 and 9.
Count 5 and count 9 are, in all honesty, a little difficult to explain. Count 5 is a count based upon a letter dated December 1, 2000.
Exhibit 9 and Exhibit 53.
It was marked, as only lawyers can, twice during the hearing, in which Mr. Felley wrote a letter to his client and said that I have sent the marital property agreement on to Mr. Lind, the lawyer for the husband. He's indicated that he signed it and sent it on to his client. I'm paraphrasing, but this should all be taken care of before this hearing that came up on the 18th. The allegation that OLR made was that this and two other letters that Mr. Felley produced in his file, in fact, had never been sent to the client, that these were after-the-fact fabrications. As to the other two letters, the referee found, we think properly under the evidence, that based upon all of the credible evidence, including the doubts about Mrs. Revolinsky's record-keeping, that there wasn't any evidence that those other two letters had not been sent. In this case, what the referee found is that Mr. Felley, in producing this letter for the OLR, had, and I'm trying to quote this, that Felling made misrepresentations in a disclosure to OLR with respect to the letter dated December 1, 2000. The findings of the referee don't tell us in any way what it is that that alleged misrepresentation was. The uncertainty here is, and Mr. Felling did testify that it is his best belief that he prepared this letter himself. The record indicated that although Mr. Felling had a secretary, he shared it with another lawyer, and that he, from time to time, would prepare his own letters on a computer and send them out, that he had typed this one literally himself, and that he believed he'd sent it out on December 1. The problem is there is other evidence, another letter that suggests that the marital property agreement was not sent to Mr. Lind until December 14th. And although the referee purports to rely upon Mr. Lind's testimony as support for the idea that there is something about, in an unspecified way, this December 1 letter that constitutes a misrepresentation in some way to OLR, the fact is Mr. Lind never testified about, in any meaningful way, about any of these subjects. So what we have is a letter that Mr. Felling testified he sent out on December 1 or about December 1, which seems to be inconsistent with the December 14 letter, and a finding that the submission of this letter was somehow a misrepresentation. What we don't know from the findings is whether the referee concluded that he in fact never sent this letter, or whether the referee concluded that the statement to the client that he'd mailed it and Mr. Lind already had it was a misrepresentation, or whether the date on the letter is a deliberate or accidental misrepresentation, or whether his descriptions, correctly or incorrectly, of what he thought had occurred to OLR when they talked to him about it sometime later, were a misrepresentation. So on this count, it is our position that the findings by the referee, which we don't attack because I think they were findings that the referee was entitled to make, but that those findings simply don't support the conclusion that was ultimately reached. The conclusion being that, as set forth in count 5 on page 23 of the referee's decision, respondent furnished a letter addressed to Ms. Revolinsky to OLR, which misrepresented the date when he furnished a copy of the proposed marital property agreement to Lind. That don't mean that the best inference is that the court concluded, the referee concluded, that the December 1 letter was an inaccurate description of when he had sent that. It doesn't tell us in any way why or how that came about. And so when we look at the rule at which the referee concluded was violated, which requires that there be a showing by clear, convincing, and satisfactory evidence that the attorney was involved in a, quote, willful failure to provide relevant information, answer questions fully, or furnish documents, and the respondent's misrepresentation in a disclosure are misconduct. The problem here, I see, is that although the referee, I think, was entitled to make the findings she did factually, it is very difficult to leap from the finding that was made factually to the conclusion that this somehow establishes a factual basis to conclude that the giving of a letter, which in some way misrepresented the date on which he furnished the proposed marital property agreement, was a willful failure to provide relevant information, to answer questions fully, or furnish documents to OLR. There is clearly a misunderstanding here. There is clearly an error, factual or otherwise, but we don't believe it's appropriate to reach the conclusion that it rises to the level of being a violation of that rule. We have a very similar problem with the other count, which is count 9. This involves a case in which Mr. Felling was retained initially by the wife of Mr. Campa, and the two of them didn't hit it off very well, and eventually the daughter of Mr. Campa came back and prevailed on Mr. Felling to represent her father in an application to obtain Title 19 benefits. Her father was then in a nursing home, ill, and they wanted to see if they could qualify for some assistance under Title 19. Again, in this factual situation, there were a variety of complaints that were made, but the only one which was found to have been proven was an allegation relating to a letter that came up in the OLR investigation. There were many allegations that Mr. Felley had not done some work, that he had not done on a timely basis, that he charged too much, other things. All of these were rejected factually by the referee, and we suggest are no longer really material to the issues that are before you, because those findings are well-founded in the evidence, and there's no basis to reverse them. In fact, OLR didn't appeal to try to get those reversed. Instead, what we're faced with are findings starting at 109 on this letter. Because what happened is, during the OLR investigation, they asked for Mr. Felley's file on the Campa matter, and he produced it. Later on, and I don't remember if it was the district committee or the staff, I can never keep that sort of thing straight, someone on behalf of OOR went back to get some more information. And on that occasion, he produced this November 11 letter. He testified at the hearing that when he produced it, he said, I didn't produce it the first time because it doesn't make any sense to me. I can't explain it. It just doesn't, it just seems to be what some lawyers would call a fugitive document. And that he did not represent to OOR that this letter was in any way a representation of facts that had happened. It was simply a document that he felt he should produce because it was there and it somehow had the name of this case on it.
Didn't he say that he typed it himself? Or?
Yeah. He testified that this is a letter he typed himself, but he cannot explain, and you know, if he had a good explanation, I'm sure we would hear it. He simply cannot explain it because it's too bizarre for words.
Yeah.
It is a letter dated November 11th purporting to confirm a November 19 appointment for Mr. Campa, signed by Mr. Felley on a day when he was in Wyoming or Montana hunting, so he was not within, I don't know what it is, 500 or 1,000 miles of his office, so he couldn't possibly have prepared it on the 11th. More to the point, the actual appointment under the evidence was on the 28th or 29th of October, late October, and Mr. Campa had been dead for 2 weeks. So that, again, I don't mean to sound glib about this, but if one was attempting to fake evidence, I would hope that you could do it better than this. It just makes no sense. It doesn't fit at all. And so what Mr. Felley has always said is, I did not intend to represent to OLR that this letter, in fact, was sent to the clients and that this is something I really told them. There really was an appointment for the 19th, and I really did all this. I can't explain why I typed it, and I can't explain why it's here. It doesn't make any sense.
Mr. Johnson, was there some explanation given that perhaps the names had been mistyped in the letter and that it really didn't have to do with Campa?
And that is what, and I don't offer that because Mr. Felley, I think, himself said, I can't tell you this is what happened, but if you're asking me to guess or speculate, I may have taken a letter from the Campa file, started to modify it using it as a model for another case, changed the dates, didn't change other things, and now it's in the Campa file because it still has the Campa name. But in all honesty, that's just guesswork. Nobody really knows that that's what happened. It was just his casting about to explain a truly inexplicable situation. The problem with the finding is that the charge was that this letter was created after the fact and produced because it didn't even exist when the file was first requested and produced. Afterwards, Mr. Felley, according to the OLR allegations, decided, I want to improve my record, and went and created this letter. How he would think this would improve his record would be another question, but created this letter and then produced it later. However, the finding that was made is that he willfully failed to turn over the letter. So the findings and the conclusion ultimately are that this letter actually existed when the file was first requested by OLR, and the problem is not that he faked the letter, not that he tried to misrepresent the facts, but rather that he needed to turn over this bizarre letter the first time, and he didn't. And therefore, that is again alleged to be a willful failure to provide relevant information, etc.
Counsel, the finding of fact with regard to this November 11th letter, is that the right date, includes that Felley's, in 116, Felley's testimony concerning the November 11th, 2000.
Is not credible.
Is not credible.
Depending on what means by not credible, I don't disagree with that.
I mean, if that's the fact, that his explanation or his side of the story, for want of a more precise phrase, I don't believe, how it seems it's hard to attack the conclusion of law when you have the finding that their side of the story isn't believable.
Except saying that, first of all, it depends what you mean by not credible. If we're talking about what Justice Crooks inquired about a moment ago, didn't he offer an explanation? And we're saying, yes, he offered this kind of, if you want a thought as to what could have happened, I'm giving it to you, all the while admitting, I'm not telling you that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I can't explain this at all. Then I would agree it's not credible. if the testimony is, I don't think he was being, if the take on 116 is, I don't think Mr. Felly was being truthful and accurate in his testimony in some sort of deliberate way, I question whether that's supported by the record. But either way.
Well, look at 115. It says, Felly testified he didn't submit the November 11 letter to LOR in response to the request concerning the camp because he did not see the relevance or significance of producing it beforehand. So that's what he testified, and then the referee said his testimony is not credible.
But there is other, if you look at paragraphs 109 and 110, findings 109 and 110, those are also descriptions of testimony Mr. Felly gave about the letter. So I don't know whether 116 is intended to apply to just 115 or all of them. But let's assume for the moment that Mr. Felly's explanation was not credible. That doesn't support a finding that says he willfully failed to turn over the letter.
Mr. Johnson, assume that we disagree with your argument and we agree with the findings of the referee here and the conclusions of the referee.
On all three counts,
on all three counts, what should we be doing with this case?
I wish this was a case where you still gave 30-day suspensions, because I think if there was ever a case that warranted something that would be more than a public reprimand but less than a 60-day suspension, that would be it. And I understand there are policy reasons that have been expressed in decisions about why that's not done, but it seems to me that this warrants something between a public reprimand and the shortest suspension you can give, and I think 60 days is too long. The only one of these, even if you believe all of the findings and the conclusions, that in my opinion implicates in any serious way an honesty or a failure to meaningfully cooperate with the OLR is the finding we've been talking about, the November 11th. And that would be the one that, if you accept it, probably moves it from what I would call a public reprimand of somebody who just wasn't very careful about the December letter and made some kind of a mistake which we can't reconstruct to something which would be a little more concerned. I don't think it warrants 90 days. The December 18, 2000 hearing date, I wish I could stand before you and tell you I never missed a court date. I wish those of you who practice law could say you never missed a court date, and those of you who were on the circuit court bench could say there was never a day when a lawyer didn't show up. These things shouldn't happen. They do happen, but I don't think it's a failure to diligently represent clients if it happens and it's an isolated instance. I think this is a short suspension, and I guess I'm suggesting maybe you reconsider the 30-day issue.
Well, if you we have a compendium, I'm sure you've checked it. And we've had several cases where the charge for violating the rule wasn't proved or might have been proved or wasn't that serious, but that the lawyer didn't cooperate and misled OLR, and that that became the most major issue in the case, and that that the suspension periods can be quite long for that.
And OLR cited a number of those cases in their brief. As we pointed out in our reply brief, all of those cases are really quite different. I know Attorney Whitnell and Racine, and all one has to do is to look at Mr. Whitnell's case to understand that recidivism is a little bit different than what we're looking at here.
And some of them had serious charges attached to them.
And I don't mean by any means to suggest that OLR ought not take failure to cooperate seriously, but there's failure to cooperate and there's failure to cooperate. And even if the only one which suggests something serious, if you accept the finding, the ultimate conclusion, is the Campbell letter. The other finding is simply there's something wrong with the date on this letter, and it really doesn't suggest anything that amounts to the kind of dishonesty or willful refusal to cooperate with the system that I think is present in those other cases, and in those other cases justifiably supports a longer suspension.
Mr. Johnson, in this case, OLR originally sought 1-year suspension?
Yes.
In the course of the proceedings, did OLR change its recommendation, or what sort of happened?
I think what happened is that I don't think OLR's, Mr. Crone would certainly be better positioned to respond to that than me. As I recall, the only time their position has changed is that at this point, all I've seen in the brief is that they believe the findings warrant the suspension with the three that are here. I didn't see anything that specified how long a suspension they felt was warranted. I think the difference between what they were asking for in the first place and what they're asking for now is they allege some fairly serious things that simply weren't proven. Overcharging clients, misrepresenting facts to clients, not communicating with clients, and unfortunately, as things proceeded, many of these charges simply didn't have credibility. And so we have I don't think they would tell you that if they had had these three charges and nothing else, they would have been asking for anything near a one-year suspension.
What I'm trying to analogize to is a criminal proceeding. A charge is filed. You know what the maximum sentence could be. But it isn't really until you get to a sentencing hearing that, say, the district attorney is making a recommendation. Is there something equivalent after all the evidence is in where at that point there is a recommendation to the referee, or is it after the findings? Or what?
Not really, because we make the, at least in this proceeding and the other ones I've been involved in, the submissions on the merits of what the violations are and what the penalty should be made at the same time, as opposed to what the parallel to the criminal would be. We have the referee issue of the set of findings, and then now that they've made findings into which counts, now what do you think is the appropriate discipline? That didn't happen here, and it doesn't happen generally in my experience, so that the referee perhaps doesn't get as much guidance as the referee might get otherwise.
To summarize then, while the referee is writing the report, the referee still has 1 year suspension being recommended by OLR?
I am presuming she would have been mindful of what they were asking for in their post-hearing submissions, which, as I recall, was a one-year suspension. And I don't know the intellectual process. If it was me, I would be thinking, okay, if it was all 11 and that's 1 year and I found three, how does those three measure against the 11? What does that mean? And then I'd go look at the cases and see how it measures. But nobody trusts me with that kind of responsibility, so I can't really speak to it.
Well, 3 out of 11 may be 3 months.
Pardon?
I said 3 out of 11 might be the 3 months.
And it might be. That would be a fairly mathematical way of looking at it. But
I'm not suggesting that's what the referee did, but the referee had to reach her own conclusion she'd have to reach her own conclusion regardless of how many counts.
But if the question is being raised, might it make more sense to do it the other way and have the findings made and then ask for suggestions on discipline when you know it might be more helpful to referees? I just haven't had it done that way. Perhaps Mr. Crone has. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Crone, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
May it please the Court, my name is Robert Crone on behalf of the Office of Lawyer Regulation. In this case, the referee did make findings of fact that we believe are not clearly erroneous as to three Supreme Court rule violations. And as to two of them, we feel it necessarily follows, as she indicated, that 22.036, dealing with misrepresentations to OLR, were also found. And frankly, when we look at statistics and the results here, I think that the pertinent thing to look at, if I may offer, is the seriousness of the offenses that we're left with, which we thought were, of the grouping of offenses, the most serious of all. And in fact, what we believe to have been a cover-up of these of Mr. Afelli's conduct in two of these cases is actually far more serious than really what occurred in the underlying case itself. Now, as far as the divorce case, the Rolinski case, I'd like to put this in context. Mr. Afelli was retained on a very simple divorce in September of 1999. 15 months later, December 18th of 2000, the case is dismissed. And why is it dismissed? Because Mr. Afelli is not in court.
What would he have done if he was there?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know, because the parties had been forewarned by the same judge 6 months earlier that he was not going to leave this case open indefinitely. The attorneys knew that these people needed insurance, no question about the factual recitation by Mr. Johnson. But yet, in the light of all of that, Mr. Afelli puts together a post-marital agreement that essentially calls for the case to be that these are going to be the terms of the divorce, if and when it ever occurs. And that, under the case law, I don't think there's much dispute, was considered a stipulation in contemplation of a divorce and would have had to have been approved by the court. And I don't know what the court would have done with that. Their expert said, well, these agreements are fine, notwithstanding the existing Supreme Court decisions that suggest that they are stipulations. They're fine because, well, they're going to be approved by a court if everybody wants them. That was their expert to say that. But that really begged the question. I don't know what would have happened had he shown up, but I think he had a duty to show up to protect the interests of his client, because by his failure to show up, and initially the testimony of the other lawyer who was there said Mr. Felly called in and said, well, he didn't get notice of the hearing. By the time this disciplinary case came up, he acknowledged that he did have notice of the hearing. And Ms. Rolinski didn't know about this divorce, this final hearing, or what was going to happen. And the response of Mr. Felly now is, well, it doesn't make any difference. Nobody was hurt. Well, I beg to differ with that. It seems to me this is a lady who paid this attorney, I think it was $2,000, to represent her in a divorce. By the time everything is done, nothing really had happened over this extended period of time. She could have been in the same situation with her insurance had she never seen Mr. Felly. Mr. Felly put together a separation agreement, she could have been protected on insurance.
Let me ask you about the referee's findings. If I remember correctly, and if I'm wrong, please tell me that. Didn't the referee make some findings to the effect that the clients were not hurt by the actions of Mr. Felly?
That's generally what was said. And I think that goes to the question of sanction, whether that's a mitigating circumstance. I beg to differ with the rationale of the referee in this regard, because it's undisputed that this is a lady who paid an attorney to represent her in a divorce, which we can assume that she wanted finalized, even though she didn't start it. And that was the case, as her testimony was.
Do you think she really wanted finalized, given the problems with her need for insurance and an inability of either party to afford it?
She was relying upon the advice of her attorney. After this hearing led to a dismissal, she hired another attorney, and the case did proceed. And I think it was a year or so later, and she did get a divorce. As to what she wanted, I think she didn't initiate the divorce, but once in it, she wanted to be protected with insurance, of course, and she wanted the divorce to be completed.
Well, didn't she hire a second attorney because her husband filed an action a second time?
I'm sorry?
Didn't she hire the second attorney because her husband filed a second action?
I frankly don't know what happened after the fact. One or the other of them commenced the action, was ultimately concluded to the satisfaction of each of them, and I think the insurance issue got resolved. But somebody said once, half of developing a good relationship is showing up. I think more than half of good lawyering is showing up. And this is a very simple situation where you're representing a client, and this is determined by the court to be the D-Day, if you will, as to what's going to happen on this divorce. It had been languishing in the system, and he simply does not show up. And I think it's a textbook example of failure to diligently and promptly represent a client. And, of course, the client had no idea that this hearing was even going to be taking place. So it's our belief that count was adequately proven. There's certainly a factual basis for it. The findings are not clearly erroneous. And I don't know that it's for us to speculate what might have happened at that hearing. Lots of different things can happen in divorce hearings. There could have been a stay. There could have been a further continuance. There could have been a direction from the court to do certain things. I don't know. But if you don't go there, you never find out. And that was the problem, and that was what the basis for the referee's findings were.
Was the husband at the hearing? Was the husband at the hearing?
I know his lawyer was. I'm frankly not remembering whether the husband was there. But the lawyer was there representing him. And
the charge with regard to that count is, as I recall, essentially failure to pursue with reasonable diligence.
Yes.
In part, diligence perhaps and promptness, but failure to...
20:1.3.
Okay.
Diligence and promptness in representing a client.
Okay. And as I see the findings, in finding 37, the court found with regard to this hearing that Felly knew the date was scheduled, that he decided not to appear because he assumed that the agreement had been signed.
Yes.
That's in 37. In 39, it says that Felly had no confirmation that it had been signed by Mr. Rowalinski prior to the hearing and did not have a written order to dismiss the action. And at 41, the finding is that at the court hearing there was no signed agreement and no written order to dismiss, so we get 42, Judge Gooley dismissed the divorce action.
Yes.
It seems to me that those findings are the findings that are the underpinnings of count two in this case. Am I right or wrong?
Well, the diligence count you're referring to.
Yes, which is count two.
Mr. Felly wanted us to, wanted the referee to believe that he didn't show up because he really thought there was a deal, that there was a deal. But there's no basis for him to think that. He had an agreement that he mailed out to the other attorney. Nobody had ever signed this agreement. Not even Mr. Felly, not the other attorney, nobody. There was never a signature or a promise to sign this agreement. And it was floating out there at the time he chose not to go to the hearing. So,
and floating late, December 14th, he sent it, and the hearing was the 18th.
Yes. Not floating for long. So if he was of the impression, I don't know where he got the impression that this was a done deal, because the agreement had just been mailed out 4 days earlier and nobody had committed to or signed it. Now, concerning the misrepresentations to OLR, this is a difficult series of factual statements and findings by the referee to match up with the findings of conclusions of law. And in some sense, I think we have to look at this in a context. This first letter, and I think these misrepresentations are the most serious of the violations here. The first letter, OLR is investigating Mr. Felly's conduct in terms of his diligence in representing this divorce client, Ms. Rowalinski. Mr. Felly produces to OLR a December 1 letter purportedly sent to his client. The referee is finding, look, she looks at that letter and she says, Mr. Felly's testimony as to this letter is not credible. And the letter itself is a misrepresentation. This is a violation of 22.036. 22.036 includes language that talks about misrepresentations in a disclosure. Now, the text of the letter, Mr. Johnson really didn't talk much, for good reason, about the text of this letter. Because the text of the letter is what is, as well as the date, is troublesome. The text of the letter, the date is December 1, 2000, and he's telling his client that he wants her to know that Attorney Lynn has signed the stipulated marital property agreement. Well, that wasn't true. Nowhere, no time, no how did Mr. Lynn ever sign that agreement. And has forwarded it to his client. Then he's reciting that there's a dismissal date set for the 18th of this month. It's my understanding we will have a signed agreement, so plan on the divorce action being dismissed at that time. Now, Mrs. Rowalinski said she never got that letter. The letter is not typed by Mr. Felly's secretary. It's typed by him. The letter contains a date of December 1, And the date is what the referee fixed her attention on in this hearing, because the letter is totally inconsistent with another letter sent on December 14th, 13 days later, by Mr. Felly to Mr. Lind, in which he encloses the stipulation. So in the December 1 letter, he's trying to create the impression that he sent this letter to his client about the stipulation, when in fact, as the referee pointed out, that stipulation hadn't even been mailed out. So I think the content of the letter is critical, as well as the date doesn't match up. Well, the referee said the date doesn't match up. I think this is all suggestive, in light of the fact the client didn't get the letter. The date doesn't match up, and the content is clearly wrong. I think it's highly suggestive of, in fact, a misrepresentation under 22.036. And I think a conclusion in that regard from these findings would not be inappropriate. Now, as to the other letter, the Campa, in the Campa case, this is a November 11, 2000 letter. This is sent to the district committee investigating this case on March 14th of 02.
Counsel, before you get to that final letter, what you're saying with regard to the December 1st letter, that it's inconsistent with the December 14th letter, number one, number two, the client never got it, and number three, the content of the letter just doesn't match up, doesn't make sense.
Right.
All that may be fine, it might be correct, but as I read the conclusion of the referee, the only thing that's referenced really is the date.
Well,
so if I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. You can correct me.
You're absolutely right. What it says is what it says, but the problem is that you're referring to conclusion F on page 23.
That's correct.
He says that he misrepresented the date when he furnished a copy of the proposed marital agreement to Lind and violated SCR 22.036. Now, I take that to mean SCR 22.036 includes, as she quotes there, misrepresentations in a disclosure. So I take that to mean, and I think this Court could conclude, that this letter, as a conclusion of law, not only misrepresented the date, but the content represented a misrepresentation to the OR in investigation. Now, could that have been more clearly set forth in the referee's decision? Certainly. That's my interpretation of it. I guess the language is as it's there. And I think, suffice it to say, in the context of all this, the referee did indicate that Mr. Felly's commentary about this letter was not credible. Likewise with the Campa letter. This is a letter that's sent to the district committee on March 14 of 02, and the committee is investigating whether he diligently represented the Campas in an application for Title 19 benefits. And that turned, at least in part, on the question of whether he ever fully mailed a full and complete application to the Milwaukee Department of Human Services. The referee made findings that there was no evidence that he mailed a Title 19 application or a cover letter. The referee also made findings as to this November 11, 2000 letter that Mr. Felly's testimony in that regard was not credible, that Felly's testimony was that he typed the letter, he couldn't say when he typed it, and there was no finding as to when he typed it. But it wasn't submitted during earlier investigations with other correspondence to OLR. The referee concluded that he failed to turn over the letter in those earlier investigations, and also concluded, as I said, that there's a violation of 22.036. I think that letter represents misrepresentations again in a disclosure. What is Mr. Felly's explanation for this letter? I pressed him on that subject. He said he didn't believe it was possible the letter was generated on November 11. I can't tell you if I know how and when the letter was generated. And finally, he says, I think the best I could come up with is from time to time when I draft my own letters, I will pull out an old letter and edit it for a new letter. And that's either a letter that was being edited later off of the Campa letter, or it was a letter that was somehow being edited between the Campa matter and a different file, and it was never generated correctly. Now, that's doublespeak of the highest order. I don't know what that means, and the referee, I don't think, did either, and she said his testimony as to this letter simply wasn't credible. And the letter really does dovetail into a defense that he's building for himself. Because if you look at the letter...
Counselor, if the letter is part of a defense, why wouldn't he have turned it over? I mean, he's being charged with manufacturing a defense, and then he's being charged with failing to cooperate by failing to turn over the letter. It seems a little inconsistent, because if he's making a defense, why doesn't he turn it over?
I can't answer that. I don't know when it was put together, the letter.
Well, his testimony was that he couldn't make head nor tail out of the letter either, so he questioned whether it really should have been part of the file. Wasn't that his position?
His position was he didn't know. He said it was his letter, that he typed it. It wasn't typed by staff. He didn't know when he typed it, and his explanation was at least in part what I just recited. Mm-hmm. And so I can't answer as to what his motivation was for turning it over at certain times and not at other times.
But the two things he's charged with seem a little bit inconsistent to me. Maybe you can explain where I'm kind of getting off the track. And that if you're saying he failed to disclose it, and that's a violation, that's one thing that's easy to understand. But if you're saying that it's also a misrepresentation because it's part of a bogus defense he's setting up, it seems inconsistent that he'd not turn it over then if that's truly what it was. Do you see what I'm having trouble with?
I know what you're saying. And,
yeah.
And if he didn't have it, how could he have turned it over?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And it, right. You get into that. I looked at that, and you get into going around in circles.
What it feels like to me. It feels circular.
I understand that. And I don't know that I can explain the motivation behind the letter, when it was sent, when it was received. But all I'm saying is that the important thing about this letter that was November 11 of 2000, the critical thing is that the client didn't get a copy. Mr. Felley didn't have a copy in his file. And most importantly, this so-called recipient of the letter, Milwaukee County, didn't have the letter and didn't have what's referred to in the letter in their file, which you would normally assume would have been there. That's what raised our suspicion level to a high level. But can you have it both ways? I think either, on the one hand, I'm not sure you can. On the one hand, either he had it and didn't turn it over.
Right.
Or he didn't have it and made it later and turned it over. Yeah. Either way, it's a violation of 2203-6.
But it seems to me you have to make a finding one way or the other because they're not consistent. You couldn't make those two findings and have them both not be clearly erroneous.
Well,
right?
I suppose when he was first asked for the letter, he might have had it.
Uh-huh.
It's just really hard for me to speculate on that. I think that the referee made her findings, and I'm suggesting what our argument was another scenario, and under either argument I think there's a violation. And I think the more plausible conclusion of law is that it was an after-the-fact creation because, in fact, on that date and on no date subsequent is that letter in the county file or the application or anything that's referred to in the letter. So,
Mr. Crone, who were your witnesses in this hearing?
Well, it seems like a long time ago, but we had a representative from the Milwaukee County Department. We had Ms. Rolinski. We had Mr. Felley adversely. We had, to look at the transcript, there was another count involving another lady, Ms. Woods. We had her.
Was Attorney Lind a witness?
He was, yes, he was deposed before the hearing, and his transcript was put in evidence. He was unavailable for the hearing, but his deposition transcript was put in evidence, yes.
What was the gist of his testimony? I mean, was it helpful or harmful?
Well, the gist of his testimony was that he did get this stipulation on the date of this letter that he referred to. He referred generally to the fact that they were talking about how to resolve this case to protect insurance and that sort of thing. He was at the final hearing. Apparently there were some discussions off the record, and he made it clear that he had not had any commitment from his client, nor had he ever signed this agreement that had been talked about. And he was at the hearing, and Mr. Felley wasn't. He suggested that Mr. Felley contacted him and said he didn't have notice of it, and ultimately there was a discussion, and the case was dismissed, and that was his testimony. I don't think it was particularly helpful or harmful. He tracked some of the correspondence and said there wasn't an agreement. He confirmed that there was some difficulty the court had announced with stretching this divorce out indefinitely while he remained married with insurance. On the subject of sanctions, if I may turn to that in whatever time I have left, we have a situation here where I guess as a prosecutor, we don't like to keep score. I don't think it's healthy to do that. And I would not want to be gotten into a situation where we look at the number of counts proven to determine appropriate sanction. But I think in this instance, the counts that are involved were the most serious in the view of OLR. And that is why we pursued those, and that is why we chose not to appeal on the other findings. There are multiple violations. There has been a consistent refusal to acknowledge any wrongful conduct. There has been an earlier private reprimand some time ago, admittedly. But the most important feature is the deception and the misleading documents that were introduced here. And there's a good deal of case law, as this Court is well familiar with, the Norland case and others, where this Court has highlighted the need to preserve and protect the integrity of our investigative system so that investigators can account for and count on reliable information. And we think this represented two separate cases, a serious effort on the part of Mr. Felley to mislead and derail, if you would, a fair investigation of this case. The referee's sanction is not something the Court has to accept. Obviously, the Court can do what it wants in that regard, but I think the Court should pay some deference to this referee under these circumstances. She did observe the witnesses. She did observe and made comments about the credibility of Mr. Felley. And I don't think the Court should simply bypass her recommendation. I think that she had a basis for it. I think it was reasonable, and a short-term suspension under these circumstances is reasonable. I do not agree with the rationale of the referee. The referee made some comments that, oh, nobody was hurt in this case. I disagree. We disagree. I'd like you to know a little bit about Ms. Rolinski. She's an elderly lady in ill health. She had to go through two divorce proceedings, cost her. She had to start over. There were delays and there were frustrations to her throughout the process. I think that's a significant fact for this lady. The court system, the Milwaukee County court system, had this case, as I said, languishing in its files, and it kept coming up on the court docket. And there's some need, of course, to have our court system free from these types of cases where really nothing is happening. And most importantly, in the investigative system of OLR, the integrity of the system is undermined when you have these kinds of submissions made by respondents that I feel represent, as the referee did, efforts to mislead the investigative process.
Mr. Crown, if I could, I wasn't really going to get into this out here, but you raised a point here, and I think I want to follow up on it. You just noted that there were two separate cases where Mr. Felley intended to mislead. I think I'm paraphrasing you correctly. I don't know if I'm quoting you, but I think I'm paraphrasing. The charges here, the 11 counts, involve three different individuals. Part of any sanctions that we look at, we have to look at what type of discipline that there will be. And there's the issue of costs. Should Mr. Felley be responsible for the costs involved in the Wood matter where there were no violations found?
Well, that's a decision that we who are asked to prosecute these cases really don't get involved in. Those costs are taxed after the fact and handled internally by OLR. And I don't want to misquote the director, but I know that traditionally their position, I believe, has been where there have been PRC findings and cases like this, it's very difficult to determine how much of the work or how much of the effort was related to this count or that count or another count. So I'm really kind of avoiding your question only because it's not my function to comment on that. But I appreciate the question.
But was there an objection to costs in Mr. Johnson's brief?
I don't believe that there are objections to costs, at least at this
point. It might be made later.
At least at this point there aren't. There may be down the road.
No. You did not appeal, and you're defending the referee. Do you think 3 months is reasonable? Would that have been your recommendation to the referee if asked?
I think a short-term suspension of up to 3 months is reasonable.
What about 60 days?
60 days? Well, I think if I've said short-term suspension, I think that falls within short-term suspension.
No magic between 60 and 90.
I'm sorry?
No magic between 60 and 90.
Well, it's pretty hard to refine which it should be. I defer to the referee who assessed all of the circumstances that she looked at when she came up to that 90 level.
Do you discuss that with OLR as to whether you're going to debate the recommendation on the suspension?
Do I discuss before coming here what I recommend? Sure. I take my orders and my directions from OLR. I'm not just freewheeling it here.
Sounds good.
Could I ask you a question that, if it is an inappropriate question, tell me and I will not be offended? How
I've never had such power.
How would you characterize this attorney? Is this a malevolent person? Is it a negligent person? Is it an impaired person? How do I characterize this attorney? Is this a bad person? A person who doesn't want to cooperate with authority? A person occasionally negligent? A person who's impaired some way? What is your view?
I really hesitate to get into descriptions of personalities or not. I see nothing in this record that suggests that Mr. Felley is a bad person or has a personality problem. I hesitate to go down that road.
You just look at his conduct and the rule and decide whether the conduct violated the rules. That's your job?
I think so. Well, I think so. I'm sensing that maybe you think it should be otherwise.
No, I have no opinion. I'm just trying to follow up with Justice Prosser to see what, to the extent that there was an evaluation, and maybe that's not your job to evaluate. I'm just trying to.
I think to some extent it is a job when we look at the factors for sanction when we talk in terms of remorse or attitude of the respondent or whether there's an acceptance of wrongdoing of that sort of thing. To that extent, yes, we do get involved in that, and I don't think that Mr. Felley has really accepted responsibility and so forth in this case as he should have. But beyond that, I hesitate to get into personality descriptions and the references by the referee that talk about her subjective opinions as to his credibility and so forth stand on their own, and I support those references as it relates to these two letters. Thank you very much, unless there are other questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Crone. And I don't think anybody intended to tell you you were or were not what your job should be.
Thank you.
I did not. Mr. Johnson.
I'd just like to follow up on some of the questions that were raised. I think the question which Justice Prosser raised about what we should think of Mr. Felley is an important question in the sense of thinking about whether it has affected this proceeding. And I don't mean to suggest anyone's acted badly or wrongly or anything, but I suggest to you that when someone is charged with 11 counts with three different clients, that even the referee can't help but look at things that aren't explained in a more sinister fashion than they ought to. If all we had in this case, if there never was any other allegation other than that he didn't show up for one hearing, and he had no explanation for one truly bizarre letter and one that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, I suggest to you, if you think about it, we probably wouldn't be here at all. But that the reason we're here at all in the first place is that originally OLR thought there was a much broader range of misconduct here that has never been proven, and the danger for you, as it was for the referee, is to think about it in the context that there must be something more to it. Because if you look at the individual conduct, Mr. Felley did admit, in a sense, wrongdoing. For example, he did say, I should have gone to the hearing. I don't know how remorseful one should be in saying, I should have gone to the hearing, but he hasn't sat there and said, no, that's stupid. Why should I have to go to the dumb court hearing? He said, yeah, I should have gone to the hearing. In retrospect, it seems at the time, and I'll get back to that in a moment, on these other points, he didn't say, were you asking dumb questions? He said, I have no explanation for these letters. I can be remorseful about the fact that I feel foolish sitting here saying these two letters sit in the file. They're not wrongful, but they make no sense, and I can't explain it.
Counsel, isn't the problem how you take this? It's in context, and it knowing what these other things were and how they originated, to put the two letters into context, I think the concern is that there was some fabrication or misrepresentation, isn't that? I mean, I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying, but you have to look at the context of these other charges, whether they were, you know, they were all brought in one bundle. You have to look at those to understand what we're talking about.
To me, that would be the equivalent of saying, you came in here, you were accused of murder, kidnapping, rape, and shoplifting. You were only convicted of shoplifting, but these other charges make us think you're a more evil person than that, and we should punish you more. I don't think that's correct. Obviously, that's
I agree with that.
And so what we have here are charges that were brought. For example, Mr. Crowan inadvertently bought into the idea that the referee found that Mrs. Revelinsky didn't get the December 1 letter. There's no such finding. There's none at all. It is because Mr. Crohn remembers there were these allegations that there were a bunch of letters that she didn't get that were never proven that has caused even him, I think, trying to be careful, trying to remember these things carefully, to suggest to you that the evidence indicates she didn't get that letter. There's no such finding. But yet we've already lapsed into the idea that she didn't get that letter. That means there's something sinister here. There isn't any finding that she didn't get the letter, because the referee found the basis for those allegations, namely Mrs. Revelinsky's testimony that she got the letters and was scrupulous in keeping them, is credible. And she said, it's just not. The lady doesn't have that kind of record keeping. Second point is, there was a question raised about Mr. Lind. Mr. Lind's testimony in the deposition, and I don't know how closely you go back and read these transcripts after this, it's not the most fascinating thing on earth, but if you read it, you would see that Mr. Lind really was pretty vague about an awful lot of things. What wasn't vague is what he said at the December 18, 2000 hearing, quoted in our brief. Contrary to what Mr. Crohn, I think, inadvertently suggested, he told the court the parties had negotiated a marital settlement agreement, told the court Felley probably assumed the matter would be dismissed or disposed, and reaffirmed again that we have a postnuptial agreement. So Lind's testimony at the time, Lind's statements at the time, when he was on the record, were completely consistent with what Mr. Felley has said happened, rather than suggesting that Mr. Felley had no basis to believe he shouldn't be there.
It wasn't a post-nuptial agreement.
Was
it ever signed?
It was not signed, but he said they had reached agreement on a post-nuptial agreement, and that when he sent it to his client, it was with the understanding his client was going to sign it. He didn't. But he was saying, yes, we all understand we have an agreement, Judge.
He got a dismissal on the basis that there was an agreement?
He got a dismissal on the basis that the judge had said earlier, if you don't have an agreement here in court that day, I'm dismissing your divorce. And that's what the judge did. He performed as promised.
Did the judge think there was an agreement?
There would be no basis for the judge to think anything else, because the only statements that the court would have are Mr. Lind's agreements, which are all consistent with the idea that I think the reason he's not here is we've reached an agreement. It's not fully signed yet. This is all worked out, Judge, and we're going to have this thing dismissed. So no reason not to dismiss it.
Boy, if I were there, I would have said, client's not here. I don't have a signed copy. Why don't we postpone this and get a signed copy and then dismiss it on the basis of this agreement?
Because it didn't really make any difference whether it was dismissed or not. The agreement is the agreement. They weren't proceeding with the divorce at the time. They were proceeding later. I don't think anyone perceived that to be particularly important.
You don't think Mr. Lind misrepresented that there was an agreement?
No.
Is an oral agreement good enough here?
No. I think what he was saying is we have reached a meeting of the minds. The written agreement is out to be signed, Judge. That's why he's not here. Everybody knows we have a deal. It's like when you settle a case, you may not have a binding agreement. You've talked about it over the phone. You call the judge and say, you can take the trial off for next week. Sometimes that gets to be very embarrassing when someone balks later. But
Mr. Johnson?
If I was representing the party that was being sued, I'd be happy to have it dismissed.
Not the other side.
Other side, but that's Mr. Lind, not Mr. Felly. Mr. Felly would have been more than happy to have this divorce dismissed at any time because it didn't do anything for his client. And I guess I just want to cover one, the 10-second point. The record is clear. Mr. Cronin indicated he didn't recall. I'm sure that's true. The second divorce action was started by the husband. Mrs. Felly was the respondent in both of them. So the idea that she had to go out and start another divorce action is just not correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Cronin, for your arguments in this lawyer discipline case. That concludes our hearing in 03-1333-D, OLR versus Felly. The court's in recess until 9:45 tomorrow for this fourth day of all our hearings.